Oh, I'm mighty glad to be here tonight. I needed to be attendance speaker. I think what I want to talk about tonight is something I've been thinking about all week. I've been thinking about what it was like for me when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I hope to get around to talking about is how much hope I got coming here. When I hit the door at Alcoholics Anonymous January 2nd, 1986, I was about as hopeless as I could be. I had been drinking every day, not wanting to, for years. I mean, literally for years. And I had been talking with a friend of mine about it today because I'm involved in an education program for first offender DUIs. And I love being in class with these people because I'm a recent, 10, 12 years ago, graduate of the Elmwood Charm School. And I've been there. I sat through one of those classes, I sat through one of those classes, and it only occurred to me after I came in here how comical it was. I had had a beer and a hot dog one day at lunch and then had gone to my DDP class that afternoon. And the instructor kept saying to me, "Do you want a mint? Do you want some gum? Do you want a mint? Do you want some gum?" And I kept saying, "No." I just didn't get what the point was, and he finally pulled me aside and said, "If you ever come to class again under the influence, you're going to be arrested." And I was like, it never occurred to me that I shouldn't drink before I went to my DDP class, I mean, it's like I was a clearly insane person. But that experience wasn't enough for me. I drank for another 5 years, and it really never got any better. It really only got worse. And by the time I got to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was convinced that I was one of those people, what does it say and how it works, who cannot or will not? I figured I couldn't. I figured I couldn't, and I was 9 months sober before I heard somebody say that I didn't have to drink if I didn't want to. What a concept, I had been drinking for years not wanting to. And, I started out being a cannot, and then I ended up being a will not, and, some of the people that are around here know that I probably had 10 or 15 sobriety dates. And I stood up for so long at the Saturday Night Live group that everybody looked at me the day I stayed in my chair, why isn't she up, And the only thing that I can figure that happened to me was that Alcoholics Anonymous offered me some hope. Knowing how my mind works, there was just no way that I could have done that experience. In other words, come in here being desperate, drinking regularly and coming to meetings, and I was going to 3 meetings a day. That my mind wouldn't have said, "See, this can't work for you. This isn't going to work for you. You're different than these people." But it didn't. I mean, I was pretty fogged in for the takeoff. Maybe I never made the connection, but I kept coming to these meetings, and the only thing that I can think of that I got here was some hope. People were talking about the way that they had been drinking and what their lives were like now. And I was real suspicious at first. I thought, oh, yeah, right. And then people started being nice to me, and I wondered what they wanted. And it took me a long time to figure out they didn't want anything except to stay clean and sober themselves. But what I heard the very first meeting that I went to, and I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous totally unconscious of what might happen to me when I got there. Totally. I mean, I went with a friend who had a DUI that needed to have it signed off. She needed to attend, by order of the court or invitation of the court. And they aimed me, and I said, "Oh, yeah, I'll go with you. They're really nice. They have coffee and cookies and... we'll just slip over there Sunday afternoon." And I went to another meeting that day because I was offered some hope. I was absolutely hopeless. I had lived the life that I always wanted to live. I'd lived many places around the world. I'd had successful jobs. I had all the trappings. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was like this close to living in my Volvo station wagon with my baby. I couldn't understand what had happened. I mean, I know this sounds crazy, but I never made the connection for a long time between my problems and my drinking. I just thought I was kind of unlucky. I kind of had a few bad turns. And I drug my sorry butt in here time and time and time again. And There were two guys in particular that when I first got into the program, they would sit on either side of me at the noon meeting every day. And I would reek of alcohol, and they'd say, it's okay, you just be here tomorrow, you know. And if I hadn't gotten that kind of a welcome here, I don't know if I would have kept coming because I was so ashamed of myself. And I recognized that they weren't ashamed of me. You know, one of the first things I really understood here was tradition three. But I only needed to have a desire to stop drinking. And I think that it's interesting that the original Big Book, the original Big Book said an honest desire, and they took that out because they figured no new alcoholic could actually have an honest anything. So, which I identify with. I did not have a desire to stop drinking when I got here. I had a desire to control and enjoy my drinking. And, you know, through the process of coming here two and three times a day for months and months and months, I learned a very potent lesson for me, and that was that I was never going to control and enjoy my drinking ever again. And I gave up. You know, I was surrendered here at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was surrendered in a place where I was safe. You know, I grew up with a family that just never gave up. You know, if somebody beat you down, you just got up and went again, you know. And I let alcohol beat me like that. I said before that if you relate fighting Mike Tyson, you know, for 15 rounds, would you volunteer to fight him tomorrow? No, but that's what I did with alcohol. I got back in the ring with alcohol over and over and over again. I mean, I belong here, and I was disappointed when I figured out that I not only belonged here, but I was staying, you know, that I was actually going to be here forever. And I don't know how many of you remember the old room at Saturday Night Live, but before it was painted and before they put a tile floor in, it was the filthiest place. You could not put your handbag on the floor. It would never be the same, you know. But what attracted me was the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. The people were talking about how they turned their lives around, how they had become compassionate, caring people, how they'd become the parents that they always imagined that they could and should be. You know, I had a two-year-old baby when I came in the door, and I was having to check the trash in the morning to see if he was fit. You know, I came out of a blackout at about 18 months, when he was about 18 months old, and he was rocking on my knee saying, it's going to be okay, Mom, you know, and he's rocking me in a chair. And that was not okay. That was probably my first moment of clarity that there was something bad wrong with me. You know, I was very, very relieved to find out here that I was sick and not bad, you know. Because bad didn't seem like you could come back from that. I mean, sick you could do, but bad didn't seem doable. And the thing that just kept coming to me over and over and over again here was people loved me even though I fought this thing tooth and nail. I fought every friggin' step, you know, until I got to step three and I finally gave up. And I had done 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. But, you know, I really feel today like alcohol quit fighting me. I didn't quit fighting it. It quit fighting me. The obsession was removed. And it was some days later, it was 4 or 5 days later before I realized that I hadn't wanted a drink or a drug. And that was the first time I could remember that happening in a decade. You know, and so by that time, I'd been around here 6 or 7 months. And I began to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Or as Cecilia was saying the other day, it worked her. I knew I was going to come here, and I knew finally that I was going to make it here somehow. You know, and today is my 2,150th day of sobriety. And, yeah, thank you. Thank you. And that really amazes me. It awes me because for a long time, there was no way for me to make it here. For a long time, I was going to have to be different than you, and I wasn't going to have a way out. But the honesty of the people and the love of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous just held me here. You know, it just held me here. I don't know. I can't say why I didn't walk. I do know that I was in a lot of pain, and I was really desperate when I got here, and hope was offered to me. And it took me a while. It took me a while to accept that I was going to have to do something here. You know, I osmosed for a long time. And I kept getting drunk. You know, like I said, I stood up for 5 or 6 months here. Every day, 2 or 3 times a day. That I didn't find that horribly embarrassing amazes me, you know. that my pride didn't take me out of here and go, screw those people. I'm not going to humiliate myself again at noon, 6, and 8 today, you know? And I did. I did. I stood up and stood up and stood up. So I guess if I have anything that I hope I've conveyed tonight is that anybody, no matter what you're going through, if you'll just stay here long enough to let that miracle happen for you. It happened for me, you know. And I would have been willing at the time to bet everything I owned that it couldn't work for me. And it has. And today, I don't consider I have a problem with alcohol. I'm not foolish enough to think that I don't have to do the things that I have done to stay here. Because I know my way doesn't work, you know. I got a pretty clear picture of that. And I don't really recommend anybody find that out the way I did. I have no power over alcohol. But today, staying sober is not a big problem for me. Living sober is a big problem for me. Ooh, Sharon's evil twin Shirley, you know. But I've had a couple bad days. Anyway, Alcoholics Anonymous has changed my life, and I never thought that my drinking could end up being a good thing. And it got me here, and so it was the best thing that's ever happened to me. My life isn't at all what it used to be. You know, all of this big blown-up egotistical stuff that I used to do is just gone, and I'm happy just to be me today, and I'm happy to be a part of this group. And I'm happy to be just like everybody in here, not any better, not any worse. And I played that game for years, and I was tired. I was real tired. Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to get real. And today I not only care about myself and the people that are close to me, I care about everybody in this room, and that wasn't something that was ever true for me. I may not like some of the things you do or say, but I care deeply about you and I care about your continued sobriety. And I just was so shut down and had been so selfish for so many years that just wasn't something that I even thought was possible. If I had guessed, if I had wished for all of the things I wanted to get out of sobriety, none of the things that have shown up would have been on the list, you know? And since I've been here, I found out that food doesn't work, sex doesn't work, money doesn't work, you know? So what I found out here was that I was a part of, and that's something that I never, ever was anywhere. And that's been a potent part of my recovery and the reason that I keep coming back here. So if you're new here, please stay here. Please just come back to one more meeting. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Cecilia, and I am an alcoholic. I guess I'll start with a little bit about what it was like. I grew up in a really large home. I mean, a really large family. I was the fifth child born. And out of seven, and I was born at home. And my father used to brag about me a lot. You know, I was like, probably the child, if we were ever out or with other families, I was the child that he'd pull out and say, and this is the child I delivered, you know. So I knew how to put on this little, you know, see, you know, look how special I am. And I used that, you know, oftentimes to get what I wanted from my father. So I use that to manipulate my father a lot. And and then manipulate my brothers and sisters. I acted as if I was better than them growing up. I truly believed I was, too, you know. I didn't really care for my family. I thought they were all... I had one brother that I really loved, and pretty much the rest of them, I didn't want a whole lot to do with them. I thought, I've always looked at myself as a runner, and what I look at today is I was just a seeker, you know. I was out and about the world. I didn't want to stay home a lot. I hung out in parks and malls, and from a really young age, I did not want to be home. I hung out in people's yards, backyards, swimming pools. I did anything I could do to really avoid that family, and, I guess it was about, I was about 12, and I caught my sister and brother rolling some joints, and thought that looked like a pretty good idea. So as soon as they left, I got in their stash and took their stash and thought I'd be real ingenious and store all the seeds so I wouldn't have to come to them anymore. I'd just grow my own. So I put all the seeds in this dirt and put it on my mom's bedroom window and told her it was my science project and would she please water it daily. She did. And, you know, I can't remember ever smoking after that. I mean, I know I stole some right at first, but, you know, that summer I was probably dabbling a little bit and I was drinking a few beers by then and told everybody I'd drinking a little bit more than I had and thought I had to, you know, I really wanted to be cool at any expense. By the following year, I was getting loaded daily, you know, drinking maybe just on the weekends. By the year before my freshman year in high school, I was bona fide drunk. I looked forward to getting drunk as soon as I woke up. You know, it's like, gee, where am I going to get my liquor today? How am I going to get loaded today? What boy am I going to try and nab today? You know, it's like, these are all my thoughts. What am I going to get? What am I going to get? And I proceeded that whole summer, you know, pretty much just a blackout. That's where I met my husband. you know, it didn't matter if we had money or not. It didn't matter, you know, what the case was. We always found the money. We always did whatever it took to get, you know, drunk and loaded. He and a bunch of his friends used to go into the liquor store and just grab booze and walk out, you know. And at that time, he had this big, red, curly afro. I mean, it was gigantic. Like, his best friend used to call him the funkiest crime partner around because he could always be identified. So, that school year didn't start out with a real bang. Didn't attend about the first 3 months, and, you know, the rest was history. And it always seemed like I did this real black and white thing. I was either in school getting great grades, swimming on the swim team, playing softball and doing really well, or I wasn't going to school. I was hanging out with all the people getting loaded. I was up half the night. And sometimes this lifestyle would go a little bit into that lifestyle, but I was always trying to make this big change, you know. It's like, I'm going to do it differently now. I'm going to hang out with my other friends. I'm going to do it right. And it lasts about a month. And then I'd just be getting drunk all the time over again. So my life basically continued that way. I real selfish, self-centered. I married an alcoholic and had my first child, and he was a bear, you know, and I did whatever it took again, you know, to keep peace, to keep the drugs coming in, to keep the housing, to keep the food, to keep, you know, just always trying to, you know, keep everything going. And finally, I couldn't do it anymore. And when I left that relationship, I said, you know, I will never date another alcoholic again. And I proceeded to just drink and drink and drink around the clock. And it was so funny. I really, really did try. You know, I tried to get the other, you know, what I perceived the normal people doing. I went to school part-time, tried to work, tried to raise my daughter, tried to do all this stuff. And, you know, along came my husband and didn't seem to drink too much. Got loaded every day, but didn't seem to drink too much, and I said, okay, this is it, you know. And the time we were talking about, I don't know, we were talking about houses, and he goes, oh, yeah, I'll build my home and put tile in it. And I said, I'm going to marry that man. He's going to build a home, you know. And one more time, it was like, this is what I'm going to get, you know, and set my sights out. Didn't take that. A few years later, I had 3 more kids and 4 more kids, you know, just kids were multiplying, and I was getting loaded, and, you know, it's one of the things that, you know, around here I talk about, and even and now and again, you know, I feel this heavy heart, you know, when I think about that. You know, it was never that I didn't love my children, you know, it was never that I didn't love my children. When I was pregnant, when I was not pregnant, when I was nursing, I loved my children. I ate very, very healthy food, didn't drink caffeine, wouldn't let the doctors give me any drugs during childbirth, and got loaded every single day. Yeah, something was wrong with that picture. You know, and it was a lifestyle. I really honest to goodness did not think that that I was doing anything wrong, you know, or that I was harming my children in any way. I've been presently involved in some work, being on panels, and this is one of the ways I make my amends, you know, for drugging and drinking while I was pregnant and while I was while my children were really young, is I have an opportunity to show with the doctors how they can intervene on pregnant women that are using. And it's awesome, you know, it's an awesome deal. I love it. And I love sharing with them, you know, what the disease is about, because I don't know who it's going to touch, you know, later. And it makes me feel like maybe it wasn't all purposeless, you know, that maybe somewhere down the line it can help somebody else. When, right before I got to this program, I felt very hopeless, like Sharon was talking about. I felt like it was all his fault, and if he straightened up, I'd be just fine. If he made a little more money, I'd be fine. If, you know, if I had a bigger home, if the kids wouldn't act so bizarre, if only they'd behave, I'd be fine. And what happened was, my life started getting better and better, and the houses came, the cars started coming, the vacations, you know, everything started happening, and my life was not fine. Now, I felt miserable inside, and what I say this often, one of the most depressing people I knew told me I was depressing. It was like, I need help, quick, you know. That was a real turning point for me. We moved to this town, and I didn't know a soul. I was bound and determined to stop using. You know, when we lived in the last town we lived in, I let the fog grow out for about 3 days, and then I'd end up getting loaded again and drunk again. And I just couldn't put more than a couple days together. Then we moved here, and I told them, when we moved into the house, I said, okay, that's it. No more drinking or drugging in this house. And if you want to use, you're just going to have to go somewhere else, because this is a sober household. So my husband moved everything into the garage. And that was like a rude awakening. So every night after he'd get home from work, I'd walk out to the garage and I'd say, okay, you guys are this, and you're scum, and you're lowlife, and can't believe you're still smoking that stuff. And I just really get on this soapbox about what lowlifes they were, and if they only knew what was good for them, they'd sober up too. And you know, that joint would go around about three times, and they'd be drinking. I'd go, okay, maybe just one hit, you know, and then before I knew it, I'd be loaded again, you know, and I'd be picking up a drink. And so it took about a couple of weeks, and I had just hit a bottom. I felt so lonely. I felt so hopeless. I felt so worthless. You know, more than anything, I felt so stagnant, you know, that I'd been in the same place for so many years, and that I just wasn't going anywhere, and it was apparent to me my outside life was going somewhere, but inside, I felt like about a 12-year-old. You know, I just felt like I had never grown up, and like there was someone inside that really wanted to get out. And so I called the Alcoholics Anonymous hotline, and I just started crying, and they kept me on the line for a couple hours and told me where there was a meeting. And I think it was about maybe 3 or 4 days later, I got up enough courage to drag my husband's butt to a meeting, and I sat him down, and I was holding on to his shirt like a blankie, you know, and I was scared to death. And all of a sudden I hear this, "Mom, this is a men's meeting." I was like, oh shit, you know, it was the biggest meeting. It was so gigantic, and I never noticed it was a room full of men. I was so petrified. Talking about self-centeredness. So, you know, I made sure my husband stayed there, and he's going to sit there, and they told me where another meeting was, and I went across the hall, and the first person who spoke said, you know, he was an old-fashioned kind of guy, and I'd been obsessed around this drink, and I didn't know what the name of it was, and as soon as he said that, I went, oh my God, that was the name of the drink, old-fashioned, it's too late, I'm here. So, needless to say, I never got it. And you know what? By the grace of God, I haven't had drinks since that night. I was fully willing and ready. After that, I went to that meeting every week, whether I needed it or not. I didn't really get the full picture that there were meetings all over the valley. I didn't get it. You know, there was just a bunch of women there, and they got to live in a recovery home, and I couldn't really, I was still trying to figure it out. And every week I'd go back, and I'd stand up as a visitor, and I'd stand up as a newcomer, and I really didn't know what was going on. I was just kind of, you know, listening and trying to catch bits and pieces. And about a month into the thing, I got a phone number and called her up one night and said, "Do you know where the nurse Macy's is?" And she says, "Sounds to me like you need a meeting." And it never dawned on me, you know what? There's meetings this day too, you know? So she met me and she took me to a meeting, and then my meeting started coming at more rapid pace, you know. I started meeting a few people. I was so afraid of people, though. You know, it was really important for me to stay in the back. And this whole time, I'm like kind of grabbing at straws. I really felt like I didn't have anything of importance to share with any of you. I had my children to talk about. I had my husband to talk about. I really didn't want to talk about the way I drank and used. I was really ashamed of it. And I'd been a homemaker for so many years. I really didn't feel like I had anything to offer you, anything to bring to you, anything of any importance that you really wanted to hear. So I, had a cat that I bred, and I was really proud of it. And it's like, now my whole life was my cat. I started obsessing on that and getting more and more cats. And that was something I could bring to you. It was like my self-worth. Then I got a part-time job. Then I got, like, started my own other business. And before I knew it, I was raising 4 children, 2 part-time businesses, working another part-time job. And, you know, I was doing all this stuff and obsessing everywhere. And it's like, this is who I am. You know, it's all I had to offer. I really thought that's what you wanted. You know, I thought that, you know, you really, I had to be important to be here. And I had to be important. I had to show you all this stuff. And, you know, I never got, you know, work the steps, get a sponsor, and do the stuff. You know, I just wasn't registering. It was about 6 months into it, and I was nuts. I was certifiable. I cried every night from 5 to 7 since the first night I put down the drink. I knew that phone number of the hotline, if that tells you anything. My husband had no desire to get sober after watching me. He said, "Come on, dear, you gotta do this." And he'd say, "Why? Why? I don't want to look like that." So I, first person I ever heard chair to meeting, I was obsessed, you know, with finding this woman. It's like, she's got what I want, and I can't have anybody else to sponsor me. So I kept going back to that same meeting, and I didn't know that she came in kind of as a visitor and chaired the meeting, and it wasn't a regular meeting. So I kept going back, going, you know, she's the only one that can do the job, you know. So about 6 months later, it was like my last meeting. I had served my family dinner, kind of thrown it on the table, and raced out of the house and gone to the meeting, and I was certifiable crazy. Got to the meeting, and she was chairing the meeting again. And it was like, by the grace of God, this woman saved my life. I came in and I said, "Can I have your phone number after the meeting?" And she said yes, and I went to her house, and I never asked her to sponsor me. I was so scared. I just went there, and I'd gotten lost, and so I drove around for an hour, and I finally found her place, and I went in there, and finally, when I left, she was getting ready to leave, and she said, "Well, does this mean you're asking me to sponsor you?" And I said yes. So right then, you know, that following, she had me call her every day. We started working the steps. I was eager to read the book. Oftentimes she had the book on tape, so oftentimes it was hard to settle down. I was like racing 100 miles an hour, and I couldn't put two thoughts together. I couldn't think in full sentences. Reading was not very easy to do, so oftentimes she'd just play a tape, and we'd sit in front of the fireplace, and we'd just listen to the tapes, you know, and it was much easier to grasp it at that time. I started doing the writing, and working this program to the best of my ability. When I got to the 4th and 5th step, I kept forgetting. You know what? It really felt real, too. I kept forgetting my appointments with her. You know, now I know it's like I was just really scared and I wasn't showing up, but it felt real that I'd really just forget it. And so finally this day I called her, I was dying, and I said, gee, I gotta work this fit stuff, I just gotta. And she said, I'm gonna be at the pool. If you wanna come down there and share it with me, God, and everybody else, you're welcome to do so. But you know what, I'm not setting up any more time for you, and I did it. I went to the pool, I brought all my writing, and I sat out there, and there was a bunch of people out there from the program, they were laughing at me and stuff, and, you know, but you know what, I was entirely willing. And that's what it took. You know, right about that time is when we started getting involved in some other stuff, and I started realizing, my husband started realizing that the alcoholism was affecting more than just he and I. We started realizing that alcoholism was a family disease, that indeed we were harming our children as well, and we started attending Kids Are Special. And, you know what? They carried us. I have got to say, you know, that my children were in a place that my five-year-old was suicidal, and my three-year-old was like totally a clown. You couldn't really talk to her without her just like acting out. And my oldest was raising the family practically. She was 10. Emotionally, we were about the same age. And my second child, she was a scapegoat. And you know what? She was really the reason for all our problems. I really thought that if she just behaved, if she quit acting out, if she just quit screaming, our family would be fine. And I really pretty much blamed all the family's problems on her. And as we started taking care of our recovery, you know, that started taking care of itself, and the kids started going to recovery camp, and we started taking recovery parenting classes, and, you know, slowly but surely the family started coming together. We started having, you know, some communication and learning how the disease really affected our family and how the disease affected my family as a young child and how that progressed into our family. And one of the things that helped me get sober was the fact that, you know what, I really didn't want my grandkids to grow up the same way that I grew up. You know, I had enough resentments against my kids to take me into a couple more lifetimes, but I really, you know, for some reason it really hit me that, you know, this disease is carried out generation after generation. And we have an option here. We have an option to heal, and we have an option to recover from this seemingly hopeless state of mind. And today our household is much different, you know. Today, you wouldn't have known it about 2 hours ago, but, gosh, we do have those times. But, we have teenagers now. I have something else I can place the blame on. But for the most part, we're a functioning family, you know, and I couldn't say that before. I had a girlfriend in early sobriety, and I talked to her on the phone this week. She's since moved away. But, you know, we just shared our mornings together. We used to have those, she had three kids and I had four, and we'd be screaming and crying and remorseful and writing inventories, and it was really a sad state of affairs. And we talked in the mornings, we cried on each other's doorsteps, we did the things that it took to start healing the family system. And I am really grateful for that. I'm really grateful for this program. Today, in my life, you know, I feel like that I've been growing up here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And God's brought me to a place that, you know what, I really feel like I know what I want to be when I grow up, and I'm working towards that, and I'm taking responsibility for my life, and I'm not looking at somebody to give it to me. And that's something that I always did growing up. I always thought that you had it and you worked for it, but what's yours is mine. You know, if I had it, I'd really share it with you, but I'm not about to work for it, you know. And I really believed that. I thought I was a generous person, but I was never willing to do what it took to get where I wanted to be. And today I really feel like I'm taking responsibility for my life. Today, I have a relationship with God, you know, and I carry him with me throughout the day. You know what, there's some days that, you know, I don't wake up and just go, okay, God, it's you and I. I can remember a couple of weeks ago, I rolled out of bed and I was kind of like, oh, honey, I really do want a new home. And he goes, oh, you know, yeah, I'd really like a new home too. And I sat up out of bed and I went, no, today. You know, and you would have thought I was possessed or something, you know. I was just like not centered at all. And, you know, I have those days last night before I went to bed, I was writing an inventory. I slept on that, I dreamt about it, and I woke up, you know, just resentful. You know, I hadn't gotten into, you know, I hadn't shared it yet, I hadn't gotten into 6 and 7, and it kind of brewed with me all morning, and it didn't get any easier. I had an opportunity to talk to somebody on the phone, to share where I was at, to get into 6 and 7, and make my amends, and I got to have a really pleasant afternoon. It doesn't take what it took, you know. It doesn't take what it used to take out of lower threshold for pain. At any rate, if you're new here tonight, you know, life changes in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't want to put the label good and bad on it, but I'd like to say that, you know, it just changes, and we have an opportunity to grow up here in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's an opportunity I didn't find out there. I have an opportunity to serve today, and it's not anything that I even desired to do before getting to Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I'd like to say is, that's what keeps me going today, you know. That's what gives me that alive feeling today. That's what keeps me seeking today, keeps me growing today. Living in a large family like I do and like I always have is like looking in the mirror constantly, you know. There's all these beings around me that are constantly mirroring you, and makes for a lot of growth. My life is good today. My life is really rich today. And I have all of you to thank for that. So, thanks. That was good. I was watching the time so carefully, you know. I was really afraid that I was going to go over, you know, and never thought to... It never dawned on me, you know, that... to ask. So where was I? This could only happen to me. Did you like debit that tape? Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Can I press rewind? Thank God I need you in a big way. You know, I guess I can share a little bit of, war stories are a little bit useless. I mean, everybody has them. Everybody does them. My recovery today that's really, you know, enriching. Today I'm a student, you know, and I really didn't think that dream would ever come true. And I truly, really, really enjoy it. I think my kids really respect what I'm doing, going to school, but it's made an awful lot of changes in our home. I drank for a lot of years. I drank probably for 16 years, and I really felt dead inside. That's the honest to God truth. It's kind of hard to make a comeback. You know, when I got to this program, I really never thought that it had anything to do with me. I really thought it was all circumstantial. I really felt like I placed the blame, like I said earlier, on a lot of other people and a lot of outside stuff. And one of the things that helped me see that I had a part in it was sponsoring women. When I worked the steps, you know, I think a lot of it was up here, and I had a really hard time, and maybe some of you can relate to this, getting vulnerable and really feeling when I was working the steps. You know, and what Sharon was talking about earlier, letting steps work you, is like, I can do the footwork. It's like I can plan to have fun. You know, I can plan to have fun, but I don't know what the outcome is going to be. I don't know once I'm going to get to a place. It's like, yeah, we're going to have fun tonight. It's like, I don't really know that, and then I get disappointed. But what I can plan the events, and then I can plan the events, and if I don't put that label on it, then I know I have a better chance of just having it be what it's going to be. And it's kind of like working the steps. It's like, I can do the footwork, I can do the writing, I can do what it takes, and bring it to my sponsor and show it, and feel to the best of my ability, but sometimes it just doesn't sink down in here. Else, I'm pretty shut down character. Maybe watching somebody else, maybe working with somebody. You know, it's really a prime example of that is I saw a woman come into this program, get married, get divorced, get married, and have a baby. And I was like so full of judgment. It's like, what is she doing? Does she know what she just did? Does she know everybody saw her do that? You know, and it took me a little while. I think I was at like baby shower or something, and I went, gee, this is interesting. Your daughter went to two weddings her first year of life. You know, and I guess I didn't really get it I never really thought about it. I wasn't even embarrassed at my second wedding that year because I never even thought about it. So sometimes, you know, what I'm trying to get at is sometimes I can go through life and I can do the motions, but I don't get it until I get it. You know, I don't take responsibility for getting the full impact of it or learning the lesson. Behind it, I just keep doing the footwork. And that's what I've been taught to do here, to just keep showing up, keep doing the footwork, keep doing the writing, to keep sharing it. And when it's supposed to unfold, it will. Not only my family got into recovery, and then my family of origin started getting into recovery. I have two sisters and one brother in recovery, and it's really been a miracle, you know, watching it. You know, when I first got into the program, it was all about you should do this and you should do that and look what I'm doing, and I really didn't want any part of it. And as soon as I had an opportunity just to let go and do my own life, things started happening. And it was, you know, by nothing that I said or did. You know, it's just their time. And it's been really a great experience just watching their lives unfold, watching their lives get better. I've had two brothers die using, and that's been really interesting, doing grief work, and it's been really very, very painful, you know. I guess, you know, I never really, but I hear people say to drink is to die. There's a little bit part of me that says, how do you know you're going to die? You know what? There's a lot of drunks out on the streets. And I think finally what helped me really to understand that, even though, you know, I've had my father and both my brothers die of the disease, is that, or die in the disease, is that for me, I may not die right away drinking and using, but you know what? To drink is to die, because I die inside. You know, my life isn't really worth living. I don't care about you. I don't care about life. I don't care about God. I don't care about, you know, watching the miracles in life. When I'm drinking and using, I just care about what's mine. So that's been something that's just come really apparent to me lately. It's really interesting that, you know, that I should have two brothers dying of the disease, one using marijuana of all things, just, you know, innocent marijuana. And losing his perception while driving, and the other one, drunken, hadn't eaten for days, and started a hotel on fire. And my father just died drunk. And during my sobriety at different times, at one time or another, you know, it's just been really, really painful. At this time, you know, I really feel like I've made peace with that, that, you know, my sponsor used to talk about, you know, when her granddaughter died, that she had mourned her death and that she's clean enough with her past that she was able to disrespectfully mourn her granddaughter. And, you know, that really had an impact on my life. And that's something that that I really wanted for myself, you know, to be able to get clean with that stuff. And I really feel like, you know, I've got a really good start on it. And Saturday Night Live is my home group, and I've had a lot of fun in this room, in and outside this room. I've had a lot of fun with the people of Saturday Night Live, and the talent shows, and the picnics. And it took me quite a while, maybe 2 years into my sobriety, before I was willing to put my hand out to do any of that kind of stuff. I always kept myself busy, like, outside the rooms. And for some reason, having fun with all of you, I didn't really know how to have fun in sobriety. That felt really scary and really vulnerable, and it's taken me a long time just to be able to let loose long enough to have a good time. I still work on that consistently. I still work on having fun. Like I said, I can plan the events, but I can't always plan the outcome. My life is really good today. And I said it also earlier that I have an Alcoholics Anonymous to thank for that. And I'm still just really embarrassed that I did that. I kind of lost the rhythm. Yeah, maybe I want to. I'd just like to thank you all.